Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Ben Rylan. On the show today, we're sorting out your entertainment for July as we take stock of the month's television and podcasts. We'll be going from the sci-fi world of Doctor Who to the very real world inside one of America's most notorious prisons via a 1980s wrestling ring and into the lives and careers of some of the United Kingdom's beloved actors. And helping me make sense of all of that are Alice Vincent, arts and entertainment writer for The Telegraph, and Hannah Verdier, freelance writer and author of The Guardian's Pod Complex column. Plus, later in the show, we'll meet a man who's travelled around the Middle East to find out the lengths rock musicians will go to play their music. That's all coming up on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Alice and Hannah, welcome to the program this week. Now, I think we should begin with this week's TV picks from Alice Vincent. Now, Alice, Doctor Who and Glow. Glow is the latest series to be put out by Netflix, and I think most people have probably noticed that by now. The advertising has been insane. It follows a group of women in the 1980s in Los Angeles making their way into the professional world of wrestling. Before we get a taster of it, have I explained it properly? Yeah, I think there's
this is a series, they're trying to make a pilot, and it really is a cast of also-rans. You know, these are the women who are desperate to get cast in proper shows. These are the women who, some of whom are proper wrestlers, some of whom are just turning up and they're a bit odd. So this is a real championing of the underdogs.
All right, let's hear a little bit of a taste first.
Wrestling is about type. You're a sexy party girl. You're an Arab.
You mean stereotype.
Yes, bingo, exactly. You're a big black girl.
The fuck you say?
Oh. Lady wrestlers, I get it. Women can do anything men do, blah, blah, blah. So you
think I got a funny face? We're empowered. We're the heroes.
You want the show to happen.
This is the only place I get to do what I want to do.
People respect me here.
We got to shoot this thing in like 5 weeks. This could either feel dinky or it could feel epic. So let's give them what?
Blood. Tits.
Storytelling. Storytelling.
All right, so lots of clues there that it's from the 80s. We start off with 80s electropop, finish off with a bit of glam rock there.
Yeah.
And as I referenced before, there's been advertising blitz for this show. So Netflix are clearly putting a lot of investment into it, aren't they?
Yeah, so they've brought on Jenji Cohen, who is the mastermind behind Orange is the New Black. And it's also a vehicle for Alison Brie, who actually, she says that they weren't that keen on casting her. But for the uninitiated, Alison Brie, you may recognise her from Mad Men, where she played Trudy Campbell. She's also in Community, and she has got this cult following. And for Alison Brie fans, this is just like the show that we've been waiting for a really long time.
So the tone, I thought, in Orange is the New Black, it's always a little bit strange. I know Orange is the New Black has a lot of fans, and I completely understand that. I was always very confused by the tone of it, because sometimes it would be quite serious, other times it would be very lighthearted and gave you this impression that you shouldn't take anything too seriously. I never really seemed to know where I was being taken with it. How's the tone in this one? Is it a similar sort of affair?
It is and it isn't. I mean, there are, I'd say it's more lighthearted generally than Orange is the New Black so far. But then Orange is the New Black's maiden series was relatively lighthearted as well, and it just got progressively darker. At the end of the day, this is a kind of upbeat comedy looking at women, and they're kind of trying to be, I hate this phrase, but real women, in that they're showing a diversity beyond the Hollywood stereotype. And I think they do achieve that, and they do fulfil that to a certain extent.
So, as I understand it, this was actually inspired by a 2012 documentary called Glow, Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. And it tries to explore whether this organisation exploited or empowered women. What sort of impression do you get, Alice?
So far, they seem to, well, it's really difficult, because the thing is, it's put within the frame, because we see it through the main character's eyes, and she is a struggling actress trying to get roles. You're kind of just shown about the brutality of the Hollywood and show business industry more generally. And Marc Maron, who plays the director of Glow, is an undeniable, awful human being. They are being exploited, but also it shows how these women are trying to subvert stereotypes and tropes and make something their own.
I'm interested to know about this 80s setting, though, because as I sent in that clip that we heard just there, sort of a, at least in that tiny clip we heard, there was a bit of a mishmash of all different sorts of 80s elements. Is there an effort to make it feel like it really is the 80s, or are we quite happy in some sort of fantasy neon version of how the 80s might look in inside your head?
It's like a glossy version of the 80s. There's a couple of things with it. As much as I loved it, we were just talking earlier that I had a bit of a problem. There's a locker room scene and they just get naked, and it's like there's no need. If you're going to be a proper feminist here, and if you're actually going to try and subvert those stereotypes, then don't just strip off for the camera. And also, they're in like an 80s aerobics class, and there's so much thrusting and so much lycra. And are we exploiting there, or are we, is it kind of postmodern version where we're being a bit coy that we're exploiting because they were in the 80s? There's something about it that doesn't quite sit right.
So it does feel really gratuitous.
Yeah.
It felt particularly odd because only one of them was getting naked. It was very strange. It wasn't even logical nudity.
Oh, the worst thing I think you can say about nudity is that it makes you feel makes people feel uncomfortable. If you're watching nudity on the screen, you need to be going along with it. Otherwise, it does just get a bit weird, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Especially if you're depending on who you're watching it with as well. So, all right, we need a final verdict on this. Then, is it actually worth devoting your time to? Because even though you know you can stop watching if you find it a little bit boring, I always feel like if I'm going to start watching a series, I need to feel as though I can commit to it. And we're talking about quite a bit of time here. You know, series go on sometimes for way too long. Is it worth devoting my time to, Hannah?
I'm devoting my time to it.
All right, Alice says yes. Hannah?
Well, despite what I've just said, I definitely think it's worth a binge. And it is good fun. And I've only seen the first episode because I hate binge watching. So
you hate binge watching?
I know. I just can't do it. Like, the moment I'm watching Master of None on Netflix, but I don't want to waste it. I have to do an episode a week. I know that makes me a little bit weird. But yeah, go ahead and binge.
See, I've got around the other way. I have a problem with getting addicted to TV shows that are on actual old-fashioned networks where they air once a week. And I can't quite grasp it. I watch one episode and think, well, where's the rest? I'm still hungry.
Do you want to press that next button right away?
Exactly. Well, Glow is available to watch on Netflix right now. You can watch the whole thing. So to BBC One now, where Peter Capaldi bid his time in Doctor Who goodbye last Saturday. Now, Capaldi has played the Doctor since 2014, taking over from Matt Smith. Oh, look, Alice, I'll have to confess right now, I was a Matt Smith devotee, and that switch from Matt Smith to Peter Capaldi, that was a tough one.
It's so interesting you say that. So I'm going to hold my hands up and say that I'm not a Doctor Who fan, but I am a Doctor Who observer. And I was so excited when Peter Capaldi was announced as a Doctor Who. And I think through no fault of his own, he has been a disappointment. But he's had a lot of difficult stuff to work with.
Interesting you say through no fault of his own, though. I want to analyse that a little bit more. What? Why?
I think what happened after David Tennant and Matt Smith is that the kind of the new series of Doctor Who had created an appetite for a young sort of sexy, dynamic, youthful, kind of gawky doctor. They'd moved away from the traditional doctors who were old and cantankerous and a bit like
Peter Capaldi. Yeah, your science teacher sort of doctor.
Exactly. So Peter Capaldi comes in and, you know, the people who love him and other things were like, oh my God, it's Malcolm Tucker, but the doctor, it's going to be amazing, you know. And he was blighted by convoluted plots. He was blighted by bad scheduling. He was blighted by, you know, there were other factors at play which maybe weren't his fault. I mean, even Capaldi came out and was like, I don't even know what time the show is on. There wasn't a regular consistency to the way that Doctor Who was treated recently.
I think that, well, that can be part of the problem, though, Hannah. I especially think part of the difficulty switching here was that we did get used to these two younger doctors who had a lot of charisma, they had a lot of youthful charm, and then all of a sudden there was this quick switch and we had this guy who almost seemed like he was doing a Hugh Laurie in House sort of style Doctor Who. And that's, I don't know, it's a bit jarring, isn't it?
I suppose so, but that's the essence of the Doctor. When he regenerates, you've got to get on board with it. I mean, I'd like the Doctor to always be Tom Baker, but you can't always have that. But I think he's followed, if I dare say it, a couple of heartthrobs as well. So I think he had quite a tough act to follow. And I can't get Malcolm Tucker out of my head as well. And that's a credit to him for being so good at that role, but I just expect him to come in and slap some papers down and have a good swear.
Yeah, it perhaps didn't help so much. A lot of the doctors sort of seem to fall away, the actors, I mean, after they're finished in the season. We don't hear about them, at least for a little while. Mm. Matt Smith, of course, has gone on to do some bigger things. He's been in The Crown, attracted a lot of praise for that. That perhaps didn't help the fact that Peter Capaldi was maybe struggling to find his place as the Doctor during that time.
I think, it's just big boots to fill. It's a franchise that's got an enormous amount of fans. It's something that's analysed at great depth. I think it's less that, Peter Capaldi was terrible, and it's more, wow, weren't we lucky to have a run of David Tennant and Matt Smith being so good? I think that's maybe what we're looking at here.
All right, so we've wrapped up on Capaldi's time as the Doctor. Alice, can you remind us, how did things turn out for him?
Well, he's still technically in existence. This kind of slightly strange thing happened, and this is where we get into super Whovian nerdism. I'm going to try and make it as simple as possible. William Hartnell was the first ever Doctor way back in the 60s. And recently, in a film about that first Doctor Who, an actor called David Bradley played William Hartnell. So what happened was, in the final moments of the finale, David Bradley appeared as William Hartnell to join forces with Peter Capaldi, and now that has set it up for a Christmas special where we presume that together the old Doctor and the new Doctor are going to sort of weirdly regenerate into the mystery brand new Time Lord.
Wow. Okay.
You're so furrowing your brow.
I, for some reason, I just imagined these two Doctors blending together into some sort of humanoid, but I expect that's not exactly where we're heading.
It might be. We don't know.
Ooh, I don't know. That sounds like a bit of a frightening special effect to me. So we are going to see a regenerated Doctor. Hannah, who would you like to see as the Doctor?
I would like, more than anyone, Sharon Horgan. I think she'd be
brilliant.
That's
such a good shout.
And I know people have said Phoebe Waller-Bridge. I think she'd be amazing, but I want the Horgan and nothing else.
She'd be amazing. I hadn't even thought about Sharon Horgan.
So we're firmly on board with a female Doctor.
I think everyone's on board with that.
Really?
I think the time is coming. It was discussed a lot before Capaldi. There was a lot of disappointment that Capaldi wasn't a woman, but that the new Time Lord wasn't a woman. I feel like there will be slight outrage if there's not a woman doing it, and there'll certainly be outrage if it's neither a woman nor a Doctor of colour. They've got to shake up the old male white stereotype.
Yeah, no more old-fashioned science teacher. I think that opens up a fairly complicated set of questions, though, doesn't it? It's sort of similar to all of the questions that have been about the new James Bond. What would that actually mean for the Doctor Who mythology, though? That this would actually be a massive change if it were a female Doctor, particularly. How is that going to go down with the ultra Whovians, Hannah?
I don't know. From what I've heard, and I do know quite a few, I think they'd be accepting of it.
I mean, I think at the end of the day, you've got to look at it as a series that does time travel and invents people called, weird cyborgs and bizarre monsters with stupid names. And is it so difficult to believe that a Doctor who is a million years old can recreate himself into a human, and that human has to also be a white man?
That's a step too far for us.
We're going to have some monsters eating us and things called Daleks, but we can't possibly have a black woman as the Doctor. That's preposterous.
We can have Kylie Minogue working on a cruise ship in outer space, but we can't possibly have a female Doctor.
There you go.
Alright, Peter Capaldi will resume his status as the Doctor one last time this Christmas. Okay, that's quite a wait. We'll look forward to seeing who takes up the role for the next series, which will come out next year. In the meantime, you can catch up with the latest series on the BBC iPlayer if you're here in the United Kingdom. Hannah, we'll turn to you now for this week's podcast recommendations, and we're going to start over the pond in San Quentin State Prison, where the prisoners have been busy creating a 10-part series called Ear Hustle. Tell us a little bit about this one.
Well, for anyone who hasn't been in an American prison, ear hustle is slang for eavesdropping, which made me like it immediately. I mean, crime podcasts are everywhere, with Serial, S-Town, is a big genre, but this takes it to another level. So it's all recorded and created inside the prison, and the prisoners wanted to let everyone know that prison isn't like Prison Break or Orange is the New Black. And basically the message from the beginning is they're just trying to live their lives and get on with things.
So what sorts of stories are being told here then?
So the first episode, by comparison to some of the others, is quite a gentle introduction. It's about cellies, or cellmates, as we'd probably know them. And Nigel Poor, an artist who works with the prisoners, has kind of helps facilitate it. And she says that it's a noisy place, there's not much time, it's quite hard to actually record. So the first one looks at cellmates and the relationships between if you hate your cellmate and then you live in terror and sleep with one eye open. Or there's some really nice warm stories about people who relied on their cellmates and there was a lot of support there. And it's funny because I think some people say, well, they are prisoners, they've committed crimes, and a lot of them are in for quite a long stretch, and some of them have killed in later episodes. But still, it's quite immersive, and it's really good to hear actually what goes on inside prison, and it's just fascinating.
Well, let's hear a bit of a clip of that then. We've got this little piece from the first episode, which, as you mentioned, Hannah, is called Cellies. These are brothers Emile and Eddie on sharing a cell.
We had gotten to an argument. The next thing he said was, you know what? If I want to smoke, I'm going to smoke on my bunk. I ain't going to no door or nothing. He just lit up right there on the bunk.
So it wasn't really about fuck him. It was like, yeah, this is my moment. I need my space to have something in this place.
And I was like trying to hold it in. It was just eating at me, and then we just clashed in the cell.
And he was like, man, you're trying to kill me. You're killing me with this. You're going to kill me with cancer. And I would just kind of, I was very dismissive. Like, man, shut the fuck up with that shit, man. God, man, we are in prison for life. Like, you know, I have 67 years to life. You have 27 years to life, man. I am smoking this cigarette.
Alice, I want to ask this of you because the whole true crime genre seems to have really taken off, particularly in the last couple of years. That's certainly no secret. But it's always been around. Like, even back in the early days of Hollywood, there were films every now and then that would present themselves as docudramas that would introduce real elements. You'd follow a real police officer in a police station, and then there would be dramatized elements. So there's always been this experimentation with this genre over time. Are we now in some sort of true crime golden age simply because maybe because Serial kind of reminded us all of just how good it could possibly be, or is there more to it than that?
I think the internet's got an awful lot to answer for, because things like this amazing sounding podcast and Serial and Netflix, if you think what the connecting thing with all of them is that they have been created by internet only providers and internet only streaming services. Making a Murderer comes to mind, and that was created by a couple of graduate students. These are people who've spent a lot of time and energy creating things from very grassroots campaigns with not a lot of money. And previously, maybe that would have gone into a weird book or something, or become something for the true crime nerds. But no, the internet's allowed it to become viral and proliferate. And so maybe we are in a moment of golden age, maybe, but I think it's a lot more accessible, and people's appetite's been whipped, and people are thinking of new ways to do it.
Well, speaking of access, Hannah, how on earth do you think they got access to do this? Because it does seem as though this is something you'd need an awful lot of, you need to cross through an awful lot of red tape, wouldn't you?
Yeah, and it's all approved by their prison authorities. But it's not that anything particularly controversial comes out, but then in the second episode, without spoiling here, it's about gangs, and there is someone who's killed someone and is quite difficult to listen to. So the fact that it got approved by the authorities as well is quite a bold move, I think.
I know that co-creator Nigel Poor has said that she wanted to make people think about prison sentences and rehabilitation in the United States. What do you read into that statement? Does it make you think about this in a different context?
It does, actually, because I got completely taken in by forgetting about their crimes and just viewing them as people, which I think is what you should do. But then there will always be the victim's family who are probably not quite as on board with it. I just think there's so much warmth, there's a lot of humour, and you think, how can these people possibly have done the crimes, which obviously is what they want to make you think. So I'm going down a bit of a rabbit hole here. But I think it's really difficult just to bear in mind what the men have done and reconcile that with the smiley, happy people who are arguing about watching soaps on TV in the podcast.
Indeed, indeed. Reminding us of that there are many facets to all human beings. The first couple of episodes of Ear Hustle are available to download right now. Episode 3 is coming out on the 12th of July, and Ear Hustle is a Radiotopia production. Now for a UK podcast that's just been released called Two Shot Podcast. This is a program about acting by actors. Hannah, what's the format like here?
So, yeah, this is brand new this week, Two Shot. When you say it's a programme about actors talking about acting, you might think, oh, it's going to be Lovies, He Was So Giving, What a Wonderful Director, but it's not that. It's like the anti-version of that. It's presented by Craig Parkinson, who was absolutely brilliant in Line of Duty. If you remember him, he was the bent copper, Doc Cotton, also known as the caddy. And his first guest is one of his friends, Vicky McClure. And she is absolutely brilliant anyway. And it's recorded in her kitchen in Nottingham. He brings her tea, they have some biscuits, and he's such a good interviewer that he doesn't really have to start from scratch because he knows her. And it's like the antithesis of a lovey darling chat. It's just two people talking about acting and how they got their breaks.
This has one of those, at least from the outset, it looks like one of those concepts that's very, very granular, very much about the detail, very much about small stories. That can be a barrier sometimes, Alice Carnot. If you read a description like this one, does that make you think, oh, what a curiosity, I'm fascinated by that, or not really for me, completely from outside my existence, I'll move on?
I've got to admit, the initial description did make my stomach turn a little bit. Like, I can't imagine anything worse. I wouldn't want to. I mean, I'm a journalist surrounded by journalists constantly, and I wouldn't want to listen to two journalists talk about journalism. I wouldn't want to listen, you know, like.
Who would?
Well, quite. But what this reminds me of, or the sound of it, is Griefcast. Are you familiar with that one, Hannah? Yeah, so Griefcast is this amazing podcast, quite old now, and it was so short, and I wish it was longer, and it's a very poignant look into grief and death. And it's comedians interviewing each other about people who they've lost in their life. And that is all about the minutiae of life and tiny stories. And I just got completely hooked to that. I listened to four episodes in about 2 days, and I think there's something very real about that prolonged conversational storytelling. It's the kind of thing that you hope happens at the end of a good dinner party. I think, actually, if someone can capture that and put it in a headphone, I'm nosy enough to listen to it.
Well, that's sometimes the magic really is just in the delivery, isn't it? So even if it is a tiny granular story, it can transcend that potential weakness by just being fascinating and have some sort of chemistry involved with it. Hannah, despite being rather inward-looking, is there enough in this to really transcend to an outside audience?
There is, actually. And the thing that comes out of it with Vicky is that she was born and brought up in Nottingham. She still lives there. And for her, there wasn't the chance to go to RADA. There was nothing like that. She couldn't afford. She got into Italia Conti, and her parents tried and tried to scrape together the money for it. And she says how heartbreaking it was to watch them try and do that, and they couldn't do it in the end. So she ended up in a workshop at Central Television, which, if you're from the Midlands, as I am, that was a pretty big deal in, like, the 80s. And she workshopped, and that's how she got her big break. And she's one of those voices, a bit like, I listened to something with Maxine Peake about a year ago, where she said that if you're from the working class, it is incredibly hard to get a break, and if you go to RADA, they'll try and change your accent. And she's like, why would I want to change my accent? And I think Vicky's the same as this. And she's very modest. And also, she talks about how she got her first big break when Shane Meadows came to the workshop. And it's absolutely fascinating. And she did A Room for Romeo Brass. And she thought that she'd made it because she was in a film. And it was on at, like, six theatres. And so she, you know, if she was going to brag about anything, it would have been that. And then she realised how small it was. But throughout her career as well, she's always done things she wanted to do. She says she hasn't got a massive CV, but she's got one that's got everything that she's wanted to do on it.
Well, that is Two Shot Podcast. It's being made by Splicing Block and is available to download right now. Hannah Verdier and Alice Vincent, thank you both for your reviews today. We'll hear from you again in just a little bit. And now to Turkey, where last summer the filmmaker Imre Azen was working on the follow-up to his acclaimed 2012 documentary Ekumenopolis, which is about Istanbul's explosive urban growth. That's when a failed coup attempt plunged Turkey into political turmoil. Azen quickly switched gears, focusing his lens instead on the state of emergency decreed in the coup's wake by President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and the resulting widespread crackdown against government critics. Turkey on the Edge documents the precarious situation now faced by the country's democratic opposition. Monocle's correspondent Chris Frey spoke to Azen about the film in Istanbul.
The film asks, we ask ourselves the question, where is Turkey going? Like, which direction is it headed? And in order to give a concrete answer to this question, we think that it's important to look at the democratic opposition in Turkey that has existed, of course, before, that has been fighting for more democracy in Turkey for a long time. So what we try to do is we try to look at the effect of the state of emergency on the democratic opposition. And we follow four characters. Of course, they're symbolically picked, and they represent, you know, certain groups of people that are most harmed by this or most affected by this state of emergency.
And can you give us some examples of some of what your characters are facing?
Yeah, I mean, during the state of emergency, up until now, let's say almost 11 months after the coup attempt, there are 150,000 government workers that are purged. More than 40,000 of them are put in jail. And this is, I must say, without due process. What it means to be purged from your job is that you don't just lose your job, but you're labeled as a terrorist, which means that not a terrorist, but as a coup plotter, you know, you're charged with aiding the coup. And it means that you lose all your benefits, social security, retirement benefits, everything that you have collected so far, you lose all your benefits. It becomes impossible for you to find another job. You lose your passport, so you can't leave the country. So you're stuck in this kind of situation where you can't work and you can't leave if you are not put in jail. So it's not surprising that so far, as far as we know, 37 people have committed suicide from these groups. And it's just a tragedy.
And it's not just people who are associated or even remotely linked to Gulen and the Gulenist movement, but more generally other political opponents and journalists.
Yeah, this is exactly right. So these 150,000 people who are purged, we don't even know if they're have anything to do with Gulen, because there is no due process. There is no transparent and legal process for us to know if they are in fact linked. But I think even worse is the oppression of journalists and academicians who are socialists, who have nothing to do with this Gulen movement, who are just being punished because they are in the opposition. This is very, very clear.
We're talking now during the fourth anniversary of the start of the Gezi Park protests. What's the mood like? Is it hopeful? Is there a sense of resignation?
Well, I think anybody you talk to who has participated in Gezi will tell you that it was unexpected. I don't think anybody calculated or was able to foresee that Gezi was going to happen. And 4 years after Gezi, the spirit of Gezi is still alive. The people who have participated in Gezi have gone on to form other initiatives to fight for rights in different areas. Women's rights, right to the city movement, environmental movement. And so Gezi was like a flower that blossomed and gave birth to many other flowers that are blossoming. You know, what will reignite massive protests on the scale of Gezi is not a repeat of Gezi. It's not going to come from Gezi Park anymore. And we all recognize this, but perhaps the state doesn't. It's going to come from somewhere else where nobody is expecting again. You know, we are not expecting, and I'm sure they're not expecting. So it'll be a surprise for everyone.
What are your expectations for the film being shown in Turkey?
I mean, there is no way that it will be shown on television or in cinemas or anything like that. So we will organize our own screenings, just like we did with Ekumenopolis. And we don't do this for profit. So anybody can organize a screening. We give them the film. And, you know, it will again spread in this way.
That was Imre Azen speaking to Monocle's Chris Frey in Istanbul about his documentary, Turkey on the Edge. Now, for 6 years, journalist and heavy metal fan Orlando Crowcroft lived in the Middle East as a foreign correspondent. During his period there, he noticed how a new generation of rockers and rappers were trying to change the area. From Lebanon to Iran, Crowcroft spoke to many musicians in the region who sometimes had to risk everything to perform their music. Rock in a Hard Place, Music and Mayhem in the Middle East is the result of his work. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Orlando about the book and his musical experience in the Middle East.
Orlando, pleasure to have you here on Monocle 24 Studios. Well, my first question to you, I believe you are like a heavy metal fan, and when did you decide to do a whole book about how rock's perceived in the Middle East, you know, that whole region? I had no idea, to be honest, how it's perceived in the region. Can you tell us a bit more?
Yeah, everybody says that. They're like, oh, I had no idea. And the funny thing is, of course, I had no idea when I moved there. I moved there in 2010. I was living in China before that. And kind of, as a fan, I was always kind of trying to find shows. You know, in Shanghai, I went to this particular place. It was a real dive. Metal bands would play. And I thought, well, you know, if they can have metal bands in China, then why not in Saudi and in Egypt and other places? So when I moved to the Middle East, I kind of just sought out shows. And then the first story I did was for Esquire. It was about Saudi heavy metal bands. I just happened to get into Saudi Arabia for something else on the side. I kind of thought, well, let's see, you know, as a test, let's see, is there heavy metal in Saudi Arabia? I mean, you know, who would think of those two things going together? And actually there was, and there was a really close-knit scene and some really, really good bands who I talk about in my book, who you can get on YouTube. You know, one of the bands now is touring Europe. I guess that was my first exposure to it. And then from then on, I just carried on finding bands wherever I ended up. So when I was in Egypt, I'd find bands, and you know, every now and then I'd write a story about it and people would really like it. And my friends kept saying, look, this is a book.
Are some of those bands, do they have like politically charged lyrics? Are there any kind of controversies in some of the countries you visited?
Yeah, there are a lot of controversies, obviously, because the heavy metal message is not perceived well by religious authorities in particular. I mean, I should say the book's also about hip hop. You know, there's some electro bands in there. But it is mostly about heavy metal. And there are similarities between those genres, although musically they're very different. Yeah, there have been some real controversies, particularly some of the bands in Iran, which have had serious problems. You know, most of the musicians in my book from Iran are no longer in Iran because they couldn't stay. Either they went abroad first, played, and then couldn't go back, or they tried to play in Iran and had to leave because of it. The same goes for Egypt. A lot of the musicians who I met during the Arab Spring, you know, 2011, 2012, they had the freedom to play suddenly after Mubarak. And then, you know, when Morsi came in, they didn't have that freedom anymore, and a lot of them have now left. And I met them in Europe and so on. So, you know, the controversies have forced people out of their countries.
It was even difficult for you as a journalist to do research for this book as well, right? For example, when you're in Saudi Arabia, you were telling me that, you know, I'm not sure if it was scary, but how did you feel?
I don't know, you know, it's funny, I don't want to sound like kind of gung-ho or anything, but as a foreign reporter, I have been scared in places, but you kind of develop this kind of fatalism about it. I mean, you just kind of think everything's going to be all right, and you know, touch wood, everything has always been all right for me, generally. I mean, I guess you're a little wary, but I suppose, like, when I went to Saudi Arabia, for instance, I met this guy, Ahmed, who's in my book. He was the front man in this band, Grieving Age, and he was really chilled out about it. You know, I kind of emailed him. I said, you know, can we meet up? I'm thinking of writing about you guys. And he just picked me up and we drove around and we chatted and we went to a cafe and we went and, you know, went to Virgin Megastore and he invited me out with his wife that evening. And, you know, it was pretty chilled out. I don't think I've ever felt like threatened doing the reporting. I mean, I think it's more that the people I've been interviewing have had the problems, you know. I mean, they're the guys who have been, and the women, men and women who have had problems.
And you know, it's mentioned in the book. For example, there's been a concert by Metallica in Abu Dhabi, 2011. Yeah. 30,000 people, right, in the stadium. That's huge.
Yeah.
Were you there?
I was there. Yeah. I mean, it was.
How was the experience?
It was incredible. I mean, I mean, when people, if they decide to buy the book, I mean, there's a the book starts there because for me, I mean, I'd already done the story in Saudi Arabia when Metallica played in 2011. But, you know, we all went to these gigs in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. You know, Guns N' Roses played, other bands played. And we all thought, and you often you'd go in there, kind of be a few expats there, because there's a lot of expats in the UAE. But I remember the thing I remembered about that show was it was just all Arabs from all over the Middle East. It was just locals from who come from everywhere. Come from Egypt, come from Lebanon. There were Israelis there, I'm sure. It was just this incredible, you know, standing at the front of the crowd and looking back and seeing just thousands and thousands of faces and people just going crazy, like they never would at Metallica, playing in London, because it was such a big moment that Metallica were playing there, and people, it was just a watershed really.
For our listeners who perhaps, they don't know much about the scene in the Middle East, are there any bands perhaps they should watch out and maybe listen to it online or even buy their albums as well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a whole list in the book because there are so many. I mean, some are easier to get hold of than others. Most of them are on YouTube if you're looking for them. And most of them, they're CDs you can buy. I mean, on my phone right now, I've got the two albums by From the Vast Land. They're an Iranian band. Sina is a big character in the book. You know, I love that stuff. I mean, I listen to it on the train, you know, on the way here. Like, it's not, since the book's come out, it's not like I've stopped being interested. Like, it's actually got me into so much music. Another amazing band is Melakesh, the Israeli band. They're a heavy metal, a black metal band. And then there's the more extreme bands like Ayat from Lebanon. They're openly anti-religious bands. I had to interview them with pseudonyms. They can't say who they are even now, 10 years after they really stopped playing, because they have song titles that I wouldn't say now on the radio. But they're very, very anti-religious. And there's also a band, Al Namrud, from Saudi Arabia, who are anti-religious and anarchist band. Again, use pseudonyms. You know, when I interviewed them, they wouldn't even say what cities they lived in or how old they were. You know, they were so worried about being found out. But they are great bands as well. On the hip hop side, you've got Damn, obviously. Everybody knows about them, the Palestinian rappers. You've got Refugees of Rap, Syrian rappers. I could go on all day. There's loads of good stuff. أصوات من المآذن رجعوا على البيوت قذائف عم تنهال على الحارات مثل المطر حسيت بالخوف أكتر حسيت بمعنى الخطر كملت طريقي والمتعب يقرب أكتر وأكتر.
That was Orlando Crowcroft. Rock in a Hard Place, Music and Mayhem in the Middle East is out now, published by Zed Books. He was speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who, through sheer magic, joins me in the studio right now for this week's Global Countdown. Hello, Fernando. Now, solve the mystery for us. You've teased us. Where are we off to?
Well, it's summer, and I chose a country that it would be very nice to spend a summer in, which is Italy, actually. And they have a very local top five, which I find it very interesting, and plenty of Italian rap, which I was not a major expert before doing some research for this top five.
But it makes sense that Italian rap would be a thing, though I have to admit I've never heard it before.
Yeah, me neither, but I have to say it seems like a very happy type of rap.
Happy rap.
Yeah, and there was even some comedy rap, if I may say.
Oh, no.
Even though I have to start with number five, that's the more kind of serious, perhaps a bit even social rap. And the main guy is Fabri Fibra. He's, he's about in his early 40s, so he's been a staple in the Italian music scene for a while. And he's featuring the Giornalisti, which is a pop rock group from Italy as well. I think they're in their early 40s as well. The song is called Pamplona. Number four, we're moving on. This is not a rap, and actually this is my favorite song from the top five. It's called Volare, but it's not they didn't re-record that famous song. Even though that would be...
But with a rap, I'm on board with that already.
That would be excellent. No, and it starts very well. There's a lot of synths in that song, and I love a good synth. But I was doing some research. Apparently some people say that his style is kind of electronic and comedy rock. And to be honest, my Italian is not very good, but the video clip is quite funny. I mean, there's a lot of people in a plane and all sorts of things happening there, like a waiter dropping water on people's clothes. It is a bit of a party there in the plane.
I'm a big believer in the music video, and it's amazing how a good music video can actually make you reassess a song and maybe even like a song, even if you hadn't liked it before.
Absolutely. I think that's the case with this. The guy is called Fabio Rovazzi, and he's featuring Gianni Morandi. Gianni Morandi is 70.
72, and he's been again in the Italian music scene for a while. He even represented
72.
He represented Italy in the Eurovision Song Contest in the 80s.
Wow.
There was a time where his career was flopping, like in the mid 80s, but then he came back again, and that's why perhaps Fabio Rovazzi invited him back. You know,
wow, that's a. I love it. I love stories like that. People coming.
Yeah,
back
I immediately want to go and Wikipedia the hell out of this.
Who is Jenny Morandi?
Is he?
This is a very Italian top five, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, Fernando. Where are we off to next?
We're off to Italy again, from Puglia. Actually, we have another rapper called JX. He's doing a partnership with Fedez, and then there's an interesting artist here, T-Pain, the
oh,
American
no way.
Rapper. Yes.
What is he doing there?
He's, you know, until I think 3 minutes of the song is only like Italian rap, and suddenly T-Pain comes and says some words in English. The song is called Senza Pagare. Yeah, it's quite. But I think this happens around the world. I think
it's
Brazil,
like the musical equivalent of when you go to Tokyo and see George Clooney advertising something incredibly banal.
Yes.
It's like they'll never find out about this in America.
Exactly. You know, here you go, T-Pain. We are watching you here at Monaco 24.
What a bizarre featuring.
Very bizarre.
All right, so we've got two more to go. And look, I've got a sneak peek at the list here, Fernando. This is quite a familiar track.
Very familiar. It's Despacito, which I think,
the
Hannah, you mentioned.
Song of the summer.
It is. I mean, you can't escape from it. In fact, I really can't escape, actually, because close to my flat, there's a man playing the accordion of Despacito every single day. I think people,
I'm
going to
live where you live.
Well, I think you
it's
got a lot
always summer at Fernando's.
Yes. And it's funny that before Despacito was playing Lambada, but I guess when Despacito came on the scene, you know.
Just move on.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you sick of it yet?
I'm a bit sick, but I have to admit, it's a good song. It's a good song.
I'm still on three times a day, every morning.
No, and the Italian version is without Justin Bieber, I have to say. Because
what? That's not Despacito.
Yeah, this is not correct.
Oh, really?
There's a division there. I think the Latin American countries and the Southern Europe ones, they're doing without Justin Bieber. I'm sure sometimes.
Justin Bieber was a late addition, wasn't
yes.
he? That was to
yes.
try and get it to the top of the charts in the US.
Yeah. But number one, shall we listen to a clip of it and then let me know your opinions?
We absolutely should. Non far finta di niente, sentito parlare nella tua città, ehi. Non mi frega di niente, non c'entro col rap, no. Con quello e con l'altro. What is going on there?
Well, his name is Sfera Ebbasta. It's called Tran Tran. He's a very young Italian rapper. That's his first number one. And again, a beautiful video clip, I have to say. He's driving around a very mountainous region. I'm not sure if that's in Italy or not. And I have to say that he wears goat teeth as well. And a very vibrant red hair. And it seems like a fun song.
Like Mick Hucknall.
Exactly. You know? No, not in that sense. I think it's artificial in his case. But yeah, he's doing very well. And I think especially the young people must like him very much.
I want to know what he's saying in that. My Italian isn't good enough for me to understand that.
It sounds like he's borrowed a lot from Kanye West circa 2008. It's very, oh my God, I found an auto-tune.
Exactly.
You can't go wrong with that.
And I have to be honest with you guys. Tran Tran, I am not sure what is that. I think it's not even Italian.
I did hear him say Tran Tran.
That's the title of the song.
Maybe
so,
he made it up, like the word baby cakes, you know?
It's
is
like,
that not a real word?
It wasn't until they made it up.
Reminds me of another Italian singer from the 90s called Alexa. Ooh la la la. Ooh la la la.
Classic.
Well, yeah.
Well, I am happy to see that the majority of this is are Italian artists, Fernando, as you mentioned, because it's not often we get to go through one of the charts from around the world and find mostly local artists.
Absolutely. I love that. And I think, you know, in Despacito, we have to make an exception. It's everywhere. So I think the Italians are doing well.
Yeah, indeed. At least it's not all Ed Sheeran. I mean, that's a nice break, isn't it? Well, that brings us to the end of today's program. The show was produced by Holly Fisher, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. I am Ben Rylan, and a very special thanks to Alice Vincent and Hannah Verdier for being our guests today. Join us at the same time next week. But for now, we'll play you out by playing the rest of that number one single. Yes, of course, we heard you. We knew you wanted to hear it. This is
Sfera e Basta with Tran Tran.
No scusa, non hablo tu lingua, ma sicuro piace a tua figlia. Sicure da un po' che sei in fissa col trap. Collane ghiacciate, c'ho il cuore a metà, già la metà. Non puoi parlare dei miei contenuti, fra non è l'età. Che barba, che noia, che cantilena. Lo so, ti hanno detto non canto bene, però t'ho già detto non me ne frega. Trovati il lavoro di una mano in casa, piuttosto che chiedere soldi a tua mamma. No, tu non l'hai mai visto il tuo frigo vuoto, per questo non pensi a riempirti la pancia di brutti pensieri. Riempivo la stanza, poi con gli sforzi di una vita intera giro l'Italia riempiendo i locali, mentre questi a casa parlano di sfera. Non ho mai chiesto niente a nessuno, mai nessuno, no lo giuro, mai nessuno. Dentro questo tram tram fra colpo grosso, invece sei sopra un tapirulan, corri sul posto. Quindi corri, 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 parla meno, pensa a farne molti, molti. Quattro in mate, ma ora faccio i conti, conti, apro conti, fra divento un conte, conte. Salto nel vuoto, ho alzato...